Welcome to the Prickly Couch podcast, where three mujeres have real conversations. We'll share our stories and talk about wellness, familias, work, and everything in between in our experiences as Latina women. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Today, we have Dr. Josephine Serrata as our guest to talk to us about parenting neurodivergent children and how that intersects with all the things that we've been talking about before as a provider, as a therapist, as a researcher, and now as a mom. So let's start. Josie, talk to us about yourself a little bit as a parent.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. I am a parent, a mother of two little boys, two little ones. I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old. And just turned 10 this past weekend, so they're 2.5 years apart. They just completed third and first grade, which is exciting, and we just started our summer break. So yeah, anything else specifically you want to know about me as a parent?
Well, I think that when I think of that question in this topic, it's like not necessarily to talk to us about your parenting philosophy, but like, what are the things that that I think you bring into parenthood from your professional identity too?
So I think for me, something that's been really important when I embarked on this journey of in parenthood was to show up what some use the term like conscious parent, or a parent who's like intentionally working on breaking the cycles of intergenerational trauma, and being very intentional about how I parent. So my own personal background, I come from a family with domestic violence and lots of different forms of trauma. So it was really important that when we started this journey, that I knew I was gonna have to do a lot of my own work, my own healing work, and my own learning of like how to break these this intergenerational trauma. So has always been intentionality, and I think my profession and being a trauma-informed therapist for sure guides that and supports that. From the very jump, just being very intentional about reading and learning and understanding more of how just very passive ways we may hand down trauma, right? Mm-hmm. It's anywhere from, of course, forms of abuse, which we've had to have conversations about and decide as parents whether or not we were going to use, right? I say violence, but what's the
physical,
other word?
Physical forms of punishment.
Yes, there you go. I can't even not call it violence.
We should clarify, we're clinical psychologist with a lens on trauma-informed care, and so we bring a lot of somatic attachment relational interventions. So for us, when we think of physical punishment, we really think about abuse.
Yeah, and so I had someone, another parent who's our field, domestic violence, and she had in that field too. And I don't remember if I was pregnant. I must have been pregnant, and she talked about how this was part of her journey, was like having to have, if we're anti-violence, we're anti-violence. And what does that mean as a parent, mm-hmm. right? And there's a big cultural norm, I think, in the U.S. and in our culture, in pockets of our culture around spanking, la chancla, right? All of that. Right. And so we made a commitment, and thankfully my husband, my partner, my life partner was also on board. But we got a lot of questions. And we still get questions of like, if you're not spanking, then how are you, right? How are you managing mm-hmm. kids' behavior? But I think from early on, right, we made that commitment to each other that we, we know the research. Again, mm-hmm. our lens of clinical psychologists, like, we know the research. Spanking isn't effective, yada, yada, yada. And so from that, like, very trauma-informed lens, it was really important for me as a parent to figure this out in a different way. And what that has meant is like, yeah, being different than maybe some other family members, being able to learn other strategies to parent in a way that doesn't use corporal punishment. So yeah, that's been a big influence. So from jump, that commitment to anti-violence, carrying over my values into parenthood, and how I was gonna parent these two little people that had been given to me to parent.
So then there's this, from the beginning, this initial commitment to doing things differently, doing things intentionally, centering like respect and nourishment, right, for your kids. So tell us a little bit about the journey that it has been to not only wanting to break generational traumas in this way, but then the unexpected turn of your kiddos being diagnosed as neurodivergent.
Yeah. Again, I think it was like, as a parent, you're constantly reflecting and self-reflecting. I think that's our journey is. I know so many parents that align with us are very similar in this way of like unpacking and undoing and unlearning and constantly in the state of like, am I doing this okay? How do I need to adjust? And so I think when we started on this journey of identifying how our children learn, right, and how they learn differently and that their needs were different, we were having to grapple with, you know, our own internalized notions of ableism, of systems notions of ableism, right, of just it's so ingrained in our culture, right, of like you know, smart equals reading and writing, right, a particular way of smart that we had to also discover for ourselves and unpack. And then it was a lot of processing of like, it was parallel process where we'd be processing things coming up for our kids, and then whoa, what is that bringing up in us as parents, and our own, you know, journeys or our own histories around the academic system, and you know, at us doing what we do and being very social justice oriented, right? We know, right, the school systems, how harmful they can be, unfortunately, especially in states like Texas and in the South where they're underfunded and they're developed to be systems as tools to produce workers, right? So there's a certain type of way that you need to learn to go through that mainstream public system, and for a reason, it's a system to intentionally produce people who are gonna work, not critical thinkers, blah, 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 right, all of that. And so knowing, especially for black and brown little boys, really struggle in our academic settings, the way they're traditionally set up. And so from jump, all of this was flooding, was like what's coming up for us, what's coming up in our own histories. My husband has his own history of being academically different, but in a time where it wasn't labeled, right? And so he had a lot of trauma around school, and his interactions at school and with teachers and systems that was coming up for him, right? So we'd be like in these initial meetings, like coming out like shaking, right? Because we're just like, it's so overwhelming. All of this is flooding up for you, and just your little, you know, at the time, Lukey was like 5, right? Like your little 5-6-year-old trying to help them be in an environment that's supportive to them the way they need it to be. So all of that is so layered that I think, especially for Black and Brown, BIPOC people, there's that systems piece to it too, that I don't think many parents have a space to talk about, to support each other around. Is like, you know, yes, we're navigating neurodivergence and the intersection of race, ethnicity, culture, right? Mm-hmm. And traditionally, how systems have, right? We have the school to prison pipeline, right?
Right.
And so,
Which is very real.
And so I was like, this is not gonna happen to my child, right? And I wanna rewind because when I started my journey in this field, I remember even back then being like, I want to develop this skill and this learning so that I can break intergenerational stuff, so that I can have the knowledge to fight systems. This is years ago before mm-hmm. I even, you know, knew I was going to have children. But because of the tools that were afforded in our profession and the privilege, right, our earned privilege of education, like back then it was like, I know I can develop tools so that I, one day I can have the knowledge that I need to help navigate these systems for my kids, my family, right, my community, right? And these are the instances where they have it has come into play and been very helpful because I have the language. Mm-hmm. And I can, and like from pretty quickly, we could identify like, oh, you know, there might be a learning difference here. Even when he was like 2 or 3 years old, right? I kind of had a little bit of that lens that, okay, then we started pulling in our resources. Not everyone has that, right? Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to talk about yeah. it, right? From the lens of that intersection, right? Of our culture, of us, you know, traditionally not having access to these resources mm-hmm. and understanding how to support our beautiful children in all the ways they need it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, you know, it's really key that we're having these combos and that we host these spaces for other parents on these journeys as well.
Yeah. And I'm still processing the weight of the words conscious parenting because as a non-parent, I don't have kids. So, but I'm around a lot of amazing parents and a lot of amazing mothers. I see what bits and like little bits and pieces of what they have to go through mm-hmm. and what they do for their children. And so I always feel very honored to be in spaces where I'm hearing mothers talk about what they're going through and like sharing tips and what they wish they knew, because I think that's so valuable. Especially for certain topics that are very stigmatized yes. in our community that we don't even have language for. So I just want to say just thank you for sharing that because I think that's very important. And I think these conversations need to be happening. So those who are parents, who want to be parents, or who just want to support parents mm-hmm. can have the language mm-hmm. and have these conversations. Just to build that community mm-hmm. in that area specifically. Because, there's just a big weight in conscious yeah. parenting because parenting alone, it sounds like a lot to me. And conscious parenting just adds a whole different thing, which right. I know parents are doing this anyway, yes, right? It's yeah. just a term, but it just adds so much to what you're already doing, so.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I've been grateful to connect with other parents who identify this way and like we have conversations of like the realness, right? Because mm-hmm. it's not easy by any means. I've had lots of breakdowns and meltdowns navigating all this shit. And it's nice to have like a network of folks that are of parents specifically that mm-hmm. are like-minded. I got like some of my friends who have, you know, were on this journey before me, gave me books, right, to help. I have one at home. It's a beautiful book about like radical parenting, mm-hmm. right? And like, and so those resources and that support, like I already, you know, had that connection with some, you know, amazing parents doing it different. That I was like, okay, I can do this. We can do this too. And so far we're okay. So far so good. We're doing it. And though I will say there is an othering, right? Mm-hmm. There is an othering from, you know, some of our, you know, familia, some of our community, right, don't quite understand why we're doing it different, why we're doing it this way. Mm-hmm. And so there is that to navigate too, because it can be isolating in that way, because we are breaking generational shit, right? We are breaking cultural norms, and it is hard. And there are so many people doing it too. So you can find those people and do it different. But it's all of the things. Mm-hmm. It's all of the things. It's hard and beautiful.
And it's so hard to explain it too, how it is and what your experience is like as a parent. It's one of those things that you know it until you know it. Mm-hmm. But it breaks you open and I think there's challenges that go with being a parent that you don't even expect or know. And as we're talking about neurodivergence, one of the things that makes me think about is that I think everywhere in our different countries, but also especially in a country and state like the States where we know how criminalized differences are, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and we know that the school to prison pipeline is real. And we've read about it and we talk about it. And then it's very different when you see it live, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you start seeing like your kid get, you know, punished for like talking too much in class, like standing up in class, and how documentation begins to follow that. So I think that there's this also another layer in our community, I think, of protection, right? Mm-hmm. And that we should always just fly under the radar and not be seen. And kids being empowered makes them visible. And so I think there's also a lot of fear, like what happens and how do you contain mm-hmm. that empowerment you've given them when they're about to step into a world that doesn't empower them, right? And so I've heard a lot of parents be like, well, the world is gonna be tough and you're like cuddling your kid too much. What happens when they go into the real world? Mm-hmm. And you're giving them the basis to know, right? Like love and unconditional care and how to take care of themselves and all those things. But that's what you're going against as a parent that is trying to break things and do things differently.
Yeah, I mean, when our kids enter the world, we're still there for the first right. 18 years of their life, maybe a little bit more. We'll see.
Probably
we'll
more.
See, we'll see. I don't know. If it was up to her, but if it was to Robert, he'd have them till they're 30 living in our house. But, so, like, that, there's that thing. It's like it's on us to be that buffer.
Right.
Right? And so the minute I saw my second grader, because I think, yeah, first, second grade, but third grade was like, he repeated third grade. So third grade, the first round was where the behavioral stuff, and he's later diagnosed ADHD. First, we diagnosed the learning disability. We weren't quite sure if it was the bilingualism, because he was straight bilingual his first few years of life. And so that was kind of like, but we found thankfully we found someone in the community who does bilingual assessments and where was able to tease out that it was beyond his bilingualism, that the learning disability was still showing up. And so then there was a process of like, okay, well now let's get his 504 plan and what he needs in school. And that's, you know, his IEP, individualized educational plan for kids that they're required to do in school. So that's another thing. That's a whole nother podcast.
Right, I was going to say, that's a whole nother
process. That was a whole nother journey. Yeah. But so then once we got that in place for his learning disability, it was like, you know, then we were able like, is it ADHD? Which, you know, we were seeing at home, you know, we were seeing it there at home. And though I wasn't convinced because he wasn't quite getting his intervention
right.
the way he needed it at school. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was more about like, I wasn't about to add another diagnosis
right.
to him without and then just kind of give the school a cop out for not giving him the intervention he needed. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I was like, no, we're going to wait.
Right.
Like, I'm going to make sure that. And so then once we eventually made the decision, we switched him schools. It was a clearer picture. And then we started, you know, on the journey of supporting him with his ADHD. And so now he's getting pretty solid support in both areas. But it was a journey. It was because, you know, it is very, you know, we're very aware of systems and the systems
right.
they're in and that they're navigating and making sure that we're there advocating. And we were. And I can see how many kids fall through the cracks.
Right.
We have two right parents who could just take the time they needed off to go to all these freaking meetings, to go to all these appointments, to advocate, to like, you know, be there, like even volunteer and be there in the classroom because I want to see what's going on, right? Because they were already getting flagged as like not, they weren't labeling them problem kids, but they were sending them to the principal
mm-hmm.
every fucking day. Like it was like all of these like red flags that I'm like, yo, the kid that you're describing is not the kid that I see at home, that I see at home, and he does soccer, he does music, he's like with kids all the time, he has cousins, I see him in the context of other kids all the time, and it's like night and day what you're telling me my child, and this is not my child, right? This is, I know this is something's going on in this system where my kid is navigating it this way, right? But that was already happening for us. And so it was very important that we
right.
like we stayed on it. we advocated, and eventually we switched them schools, and they're both in a school now that's for kids with dyslexia. My second one also got identified in first grade. It was easier when once we saw, I was like, I think he needs to get assessed. And then we did it, and then boom, we were able, thankfully, and we're, again, very privileged and lucky that we're able to be on this journey to, you know, support them the same way. And there's so many kids that fall through the cracks and that I can see. Like, my kid was already, his self-esteem was already being hit. Mm-hmm. He was already feeling and saying things like, I'm so dumb, I can't read. He was 9 years old, right? Like, no parent ever wants to hear their child, right, talking down about themselves. And so it was, at that point, it was like, big change needs to happen. This is not, like, I am committed to public schools. I value, right? Like, it was a bilingual school. I valued bilingual education. I value, like, this is aligned with my values and not at the expense of my children, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was the point we had to make. And we did. We moved them to a different school and they're thriving, right? Not to say that we won't push, you know, won't transition them back to public school later. It's just at their that age that they were at, it's like foundational, mm-hmm. developmentally, and to see your child already developing this script in his head that he's not good enough because he can't read at the level of his other peers, mm-hmm. was not okay.
And I think that, again, like, just knowing what the research says about, you know, when folks don't get access to interventions with ADHD, the picture isn't
right.
a positive one, right? Like, we know all the things that could happen, and so you're seeing it, like, 5 steps behind. And also, you were in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So as, you know, Joseph was going through this process, the pandemic happened. So then how do you provide accommodations at home while your kid has these expectations of showing up mm-hmm. online and completing this work? I mean, it was intense.
Brutal. And so we got his IEP approved, like the intervention. So that's when they're like, yes, go through this process, right? Again, we'll do another episode on that. They go through this whole process. And then they're like, okay, it's in place. Now they have to do the intervention. That means they have to pull him out of his classroom and give him a one-on-one reading time. That means the teacher has to have him in, like, small group, like all these things that he needs. The pandemic hit. We literally passed it, and then we shut down. And then he was home that whole rest of that, his first grade year, started second grade at home. Because we had his IEP in place and he received special education services, we were able to put him in school actually earlier than other schools' mm-hmm. kids started. So he actually started that fall, when most kids waited until, like, spring or even the following year to come in. But he was in the fall. And that year was great for him because it was the classroom was so small, which is like him and one other kid. And then Santi got to go too because his brother was in. And so they were in, but once all of that lifted and they were kind of quote unquote regular classroom again with 25 kids in the classroom with one teacher managing all of that, that's when it was like we really saw and the gap, right, that happened
right.
because of the pandemic. I think that contributed to the gap widening for him, for them, for both of them. But again, thankfully they're doing so well right now, and they're thriving, and they're back to, like, because even like my first grader Santi, it started happening for him where he was like not wanting to go to school or just feeling like down about going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to visit him. It was like, it was in the fall. I went to visit him for like Thanksgiving break. And, you know, Thanksgiving, you know, they have like you can come with the parents and have lunch with them. So I came to visit him and he was just sitting there, Borrecito, with his like head in his plate. Like he didn't eat, you know, usually when you go, they're like, ah, Mama, you're here. Mm-hmm. Super excited to see you, right? And he wasn't excited to see me. He was like, you know, head down. And I was like, ¿Qué pasó, papi? You know, ¿qué está pasando? And Mama's here. And he said, Mama, I already went to the principal's office. He had already been to the principal's mm-hmm. office. His teacher was sending calls, again, no no shade to the teacher, because she was completely, the teachers are super overwhelmed, and we're in Texas, and that's a whole thing. But the teacher was sending kids to the office just to have a way to manage her classroom. Mm-hmm. But he's a six-year-old going to the principal. Like, that's a big fucking deal any kid. Yeah. And so already at 10:30 in the morning, had already been to the principal's office and was already feeling super shitty about himself. And so it was like, y'all, this is not okay for our babies, for our children. So we intervened.
And now they're thriving.
And now they're doing so much better. They just finished school, and they super excited about showing us all. Like, he's super proud of his work. Yeah. Santi, and he comes home. But they both are. And he comes home. The school's four kids with dyslexia, so that very hands-on, very experiential, lots of art, activities, you know, I don't know another way to say it, hands-on stuff. What's the word for it? There's a specific word for it, but and so they do a lot of like projects, right? Mm-hmm. And so he comes home, and sure enough, they brought all their shit home from school from the whole year. So they come home and like showing all his projects and like super excited about, so that love for learning is back. And it's beautiful, and I love it to see it.
So now that we're like getting to wrap up, if you had to summarize like three things or more of things that parents should have in mind as they are parenting neurodivergent children, they're coming across the systems, including our familias and comunidad, what would you say? What was helpful?
I think, well, you know, having a network of other parents that you can connect with to support you through the journey for sure. Just having, your network of your people that you can reach out to who aren't, you know, who you just talk to and cry with or share frustration with or whatever, the process that you're going through. And just to like be able to unpack for yourself and process your pack. I mean, I'm a therapist, I'm a psychologist, so I advocate for therapy. I'm my own therapist. That was very, very important, very helpful through this journey. And the colleagues and friends who could support it, just to, you know, just to vent and just to like process, right? Because it's mm-hmm. a lot. Definitely prioritizing like self-care in a way that isn't like necessarily just like going to the spa, which is great, that's good too. But like developing skills, especially with the child with ADHD, you know, meltdowns, because if they get overstimulated with stimuli, right? Meltdowns is a thing and still continues to be a thing. And so being able to like have skills in your toolbox that help you regulate so that you can co-regulate is key. Like really working at like how you calm your nervous system, how do you take breaks, communicating that with your, if you have a co-parent, if you have a partner, communicating that with them so y'all have strategies for how to like tap in and tap out. We went to a parenting coach to help us learn strategies with among ourselves, the parents, so that we could best support the boys around, especially around like the neurodivergence pieces and the overstimulation that happens and the emotion dysregulation that happens. And so being able to like stay connected and supported to each other was really important. Practicing self-care. So, you know, when they leave for the day, it's easy for me to jump into work, right? But rather like making sure I pause and giving myself time to like have either take a walk, or when they're going to transition back home, like be intentional about my time as a parent and knowing that I need to be okay for them mm-hmm. to be okay. It's actually like mm-hmm. the days where I don't do that, it's a shit storm for all of us.
Because it's so easy to be like, okay, I have time off, let me do work. Versus like, in the days that I have where the kid, or my kid, or, you know, in your case, the kids leave, there also has to be time for self-care. And it can't just be work. And that makes it harder to balance all the things.
No, I mean, it's like so key, so key. I mean, even it could be some simple, like a 5-minute meditation or
a walk,
stopping in the car, you know, before you get out to pick them up from daycare, just pause there for a minute, put on something to listen to and just like breathe. Like you're literally regulating your nervous system all the time. Mm-hmm. because you have to be the stable force for them. Because children are, you know, all emotions and all, you know, shenanigans all the time, especially my two with all their energy. So you have to be that stable force. So that it definitely is important. And then spending time with your partner, if you are partnered, if you are co-parenting, like that relationship is really important to be solid. And also like for y'all to have a plan, to communicate, to co-regulate, so that you're in it together, because it can take a big toll. I just watched, someone had a video up, I don't know, probably TikTok, probably my perusing TikTok. But she like talked about, yeah, parents, the relationship, the impact, parenting neurodivergence, the impact it has on the relationship. And she described being like hypervigilant. And that can definitely happen where, you know, for me, it's me where I'm very hypervigilant of, you know, my partner's tone, and like, cause you're dysregulated, the system's dysregulated, right? And so that's part of neurodivergence, right? It's part of ADHD, is emotion dysregulation, but your whole system, the whole family system becomes dysregulated, right? And then for me, my trauma response is like, right? Like I fight. And so all of that has come up. And so we've had to work on our relationship and our communication and coming together to parent these beautiful children. So that dynamic is
another podcast episode.
And so yes, those are my three hot takes right now, currently in this current situation.
Thank you. So we'll pause there, and then just so you know, there is a blog episode that will accompany this podcast recording, and we'll make sure to add some resources to our page so you have them there for parenting and learning a little bit more. Thank you, Joseph.
And we have a workshop.
Yes, we have a workshop series coming up, and so we'll be announcing that on our social media. So check it out. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for having me.